Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
To investors, it's all Greek. A spending party in Greece caused markets across the world to sell off yesterday. The Greeks want to keep borrowing, and Wall Street is getting scared. The Dow lost more than 250 points yesterday.
The markets are betting against them, saying they can't keep doing it.
Now, can a glimmer of positive news on the U.S. jobless rate turn things around today? The unemployment rate drops from 10% to 9.7%. In globalism's dizzy dance, workers have to read Greek and step lively on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning, everyone. Friday, February 5th, and The Takeaway is trying to gauge reaction to that unexpected jobless number, 9.7% from 10%.
That's a good sign,
could
right?
Be,
I mean, we had lots of experts who said it would happen in February, and look at... They were right. Well, let's get right to the top stories this morning. The unemployment rate, as you said, it dropped to 9.7%, even with 20,000 jobs being lost. The Labor Department says that's because a survey of households found the number of employed Americans rose by 500,000. The job losses are calculated separately. All told, the department says the Great Recession has eliminated 8.5 million jobs. That's the most of any recession since World War II. President Obama's priority is turning that around. As part of his focus on job creation, he's expected to press Congress to temporarily expand two lending programs for owners of small businesses. The plan's expected to be announced today. It would temporarily increase the cap on Small Business Administration Express loans from the current maximum of $350,000 to $1 million.
All part of the details investors are going to be taking a look at today. We're rejoined by Michael Hunter, markets reporter with the Financial Times. Michael, good morning.
Good morning, Sean.
So is there any reaction so far to this unexpected unemployment number?
Yeah, we're off session lows in London, and Wall Street futures have picked up. You were saying earlier the Dow lost 250 points yesterday. It's still going to fall, we think. It's going to lose only about 7 points. There are much larger declines forecast earlier. And you're absolutely right. The overall unemployment rates come in below forecast levels, meaning more people are in jobs, and that's cheered sentiment on markets around the world.
Well, they've got the whole day to chew it over and to find some clarity in all this. Michael Hunter, thanks so much for following this. We're going to talk more about the economy in just a moment. An apology but no recall from Toyota's president this morning.
Please believe me, we always customer first is first priority.
Akio Toyota also said Toyota would soon announce what steps it will take to address brake problems in its 2010 Prius model. They did not announce another recall, though. Toyota is investigating possible brake problems with its Lexus hybrid as well. The company says it hasn't received any complaints about the car, but it's looking into it because the Lexus uses the same brake system as the Prius. The NATO offensive in Afghanistan is underway this morning. British troops are now carrying out helicopter advances in the Helmand province. They're preparing the battlefield for what will be one of the largest assaults in the eight-year-old war. General Stanley McChrystal, the top U.S. commander in Afghanistan, says one reason he announced the offensive in advance was to give insurgents a chance to lay down their arms.
We're trying to signal to the Afghan people that we are expanding security where they live. We are trying also to signal to the insurgents, the Taliban primarily in this area, and the narco-traffickers, that it's about to change.
U.S. commanders say the offensive will be backed by a larger Afghan contingent than ever before. Looking at the markets, futures are now flat after positive unemployment numbers. The Dow will start at 10,002. The S&P starts at 1,063. And the NASDAQ opens at 2,125. We're going to talk to two people who've written a photojournalism book that compares the relationship between Haitians and Cubans in Miami.
Some fascinating and beautiful pictures there. And the Tea Party Convention moves into day two down in Nashville. We're asking our listeners to tell us the platforms of their own political parties.
The party that I would go for is, number one, the Truth Party. The platform is to tell the truth about what's really going on, not spin, and then make your decisions based on that.
Thank you, Doris from Flint, Michigan. You can call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email mytake@thetakeaway.org. Coming up, the economic numbers.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Good morning this morning. Good morning, everyone. You might say it's a double dose, a dose of political sensitivity and economic volatility. Numbers out of the Labor Department this morning, unexpected and very, very interesting. The unemployment rate dropped in January to 9.7% from 10%. That's even with 20,000 jobs being lost out of a total sample set of about 130 million. The Labor Department says it's because a survey of households found the number of employed Americans rose by a 500,000. The job losses are calculated separately. All told, this complicated statistic shows that the Great Recession has eliminated 8.5 million jobs. That's the most of any recession since World War II. But 9.7% is a positive number. And joining us to talk about it is Floyd Norris. He's the chief financial correspondent for our partner, the New York Times. Good morning, Floyd. And also with us is Elizabeth Williamson, who's the White House correspondent for the Wall Street Journal. Good morning, Elizabeth.
Good morning.
So, Elizabeth, first of all, let's try to take this complicated number apart. The job losses are different from the job gains, and so the percentage number is a sort of something of a composite. Explain how that's calculated.
That's a tricky one. Well, basically, this is based on a survey of households, which is why you see a revision in the number, quite a substantial one, by the way. There are now 9.3 million Americans out of work as of December, and that's a big revision based on a look back to 2008 by the Labor Department. So those numbers, I mean, focusing on the numbers of Americans that are out there looking for work, focusing on the underemployment in addition to the actual jobless rate is the correct way to look at these figures.
But it also makes it hard for, say, Barack Obama to come out today and take credit for a lot of positive news when those numbers, as you say, don't necessarily translate into a lot of good feelings on the part of voters, correct?
You're absolutely right, John. What business hates is uncertainty, and what these numbers actually do is add to that uncertainty. So they really do give and take away.
All right. So, Floyd Norris, we saw yesterday the effect of uncertainty about debt issuing in Europe caused all kind of volatility on the market. So what do you think the reaction is likely to be today?
Well, the markets around the world were selling off this morning, and they seem to have bounced back a little bit, at least the U.S. futures on the jobs news, which generally I think looks pretty good. One interesting fact in it is that their survey says the number of people with manufacturing jobs went up last month, and that's the first time that's happened since January of 2007.
Yeah, it was something like 11,000 jobs, factory jobs,
it was,
right?
It was 11,000 jobs. Yeah. These are, you know, these numbers are subject to considerable error, and you shouldn't jump all over them. But they do show what we've known from a lot of other studies. The manufacturing sector is coming back, not only here but around the world. And there is a decent recovery going on, it appears, even though people are very glum about it.
Which is an argument, Elizabeth Williamson, for the Obama administration to stay on the jobs message and to stay on the we are growing manufacturing, we are creating jobs here, even if that's not necessarily an absolute truth out of these figures, correct?
No, that's absolutely true. And I think you will see them really capitalize on the manufacturing numbers and say that this is proof that the stimulus and some of the other efforts they're attempting to make, although those have, you know, arguably not yet taken full route, are starting to move numbers in the right direction. Manufacturing is enormous for this administration, and the fact that you would see some growth in manufacturing jobs is very important for their message.
So if the Obama administration tries to use that as their message today, Floyd Norris, what would be wrong with that, looking at the numbers the way you see them as a financial correspondent?
Well, I think the one of the great problems is administrations seek to take credit for good news and to escape blame for bad news, and there's a little truth in both. It's they managed last year, not only this administration, but to a significant extent the prior administration and a lot of other governments around the world, to rescue us from a very severe credit crisis and panic, and things are looking good now. Another thing in the unemployment numbers that I think is worth noting is that for the first time in a while, we're seeing a decline in the number of people who say they're unemployed because they lost their job. And we're seeing an increase in the number of people who are unemployed because they've decided to enter the labor force.
Well, that's interesting. So these are voluntary career changes.
Well, it's the people re-entering the the labor force are presumably people who were discouraged, or at least many of them are. Obviously, you may be re-entering the labor force for other reasons. Your child is now old enough, you feel comfortable going back to work or whatever. But we've been seeing an awful lot of unemployed who had simply gotten fired. And we still have a lot who got that, but that number seems to be turning down.
That's interesting. That's so what's really important for the administration, you know, forget today's photo op, Elizabeth Williamson, is to really predict where the unemployment number is going to be in 2012 when they're going to be running again, and certainly much later this year when the off-year election is taking place. Any sign in these numbers that that prediction is going to make any sense?
Well, that's a really tricky endeavor, as we've already discussed, and as you see from the constant revisions that come out when the figures are released each month. But they did make an attempt to do this when they released the budget on Monday, and you know, it was a negative picture. I mean, the unemployment rate going into Mr. Obama's reelection campaign still doesn't look very good. I mean, they had said when they signed in February, just about a year ago, the Recovery Act, that they thought it would reduce the jobless rate to about 8%. That hasn't happened. And now they don't predict, there's now diminishing expectations. They don't predict that the jobless rate will fall below 8% at any time before he runs for reelection.
Finally, Floyd Norris, will the markets today be looking for a confidence-building number out of these unemployment figures in the sense that so many investors believe that American consumers are kind of the cash ATM in the global economy?
I think people are interested in what American consumers will do, but I think this is providing a little bit of good news at a time when the nervousness out of Europe was providing bad news, and that should stop the decline in the markets today, or at least certainly minimize it.
All right. Well, it certainly turned the futures around, which were really negative this morning and now are mostly flat. So even though there may be an end-of-day loss on the Dow Jones Industrial Average, it looks like a flat opening. Floyd Norris, chief financial correspondent for our partner, the New York Times, and Elizabeth Williamson, White House reporter for the Wall Street Journal, reacting to the 9.7 unemployment rate for the month of January. And at 15 minutes after the hour, let's go back to the headlines. Les?
In economic news, the Labor Department, as you said, says the unemployment rate fell slightly last month to 9.7%. That's down from 10% in December. Moving on to Toyota. In his first press conference since the global recalls began, Toyota President Akio Toyoda apologized to customers and said he's doing his best to get vehicles fixed.
I'm trying to do this work as soon as possible and with cooperation of our employee and our supplier and the dealers.
Toyota is considering a recall on 270,000 Prius hybrid cars over brake problems. The automaker is also taking a closer look at their Lexus hybrid to see if it has the same problem. We're going to get more on this story in just a few minutes.
Those 10 American missionaries who've been charged now with kidnapping children in Haiti are facing up to 3 months in detention as they simply wait for a trial. Their defense attorney, Edwin Koch, blames the group leader, Laura Silsby. He says she was told several times she would be arrested if she took the 33 children out of the country, but he says he'll do his best for the other nine. In Iraq, a car bomb explosion on the outskirts of the southern holy city of Karbala has killed at least 27 Shiite pilgrims. And back in the U.S., there are winter storm warnings for the Mid-Atlantic, including states from Virginia to New Jersey. The storm could bring 1 or 2 feet of snow to some area. Bruce Terry, a meteorologist from the National Weather Service, predicts the storm will be dangerous.
That's a look. In addition to 1 to 2 feet of snow accumulation on the ground, it will become very windy later Friday night and Saturday. So in a lot of places, there's going to be near blizzard conditions or maybe blizzard conditions.
That's the storm expected to move out by tomorrow. That's some of the stories we're watching this morning. Coming up, who had a good week and who had a bad week?
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Hey, you want that to go?
Now it's time for some news takeouts on stories you're following this week. And the big story this week, of course, is Toyota. We got an apology, another apology, from Toyota's president this morning.
Please believe me, we always, customer first is first priority.
Akio Toyota also said Toyota will soon announce what steps it will take to address brake problems in its 2010 Prius model. They did not announce another recall, though. Toyota is also investigating possible brake problems with the Lexus hybrid. They haven't received any complaints about the car, they say, but they're looking into it because Lexus uses the same brake system as the Prius. Joining us now is Hiroko Tabuchi. She's the New York Times business reporter in Japan, and she was at the Toyota's president's press conference this morning. Good morning.
Hi, Celeste.
Do we know why they're delaying calling for another recall on those 270,000 Prius models that could have possible brake problems?
Right, yes, that was a surprise to us. We had expected Mr. Toyota to announce a Prius recall, especially because of all the criticism and it was receiving in the States and of all the reports of brake malfunctions. But Mr. Toyota told us that Toyota was still looking into a lot of the reports it was receiving and that it had not yet found cause to issue a recall. It's not quite clear why Toyota is taking so long, especially because it has also received criticism for being very slow to issue some of the recalls, for example, with the sticking pedals and also with the floor mats. And so, again, Toyota appeared to be dragging its feet, and I don't think that was a very good move on Toyota's part.
Well,
and
as
it was, big surprise for us.
As you say, a lot of the criticism right now is coming over the fact that Toyota has been secretive when problems have occurred, that they've fixed them, but haven't actually issued recalls when they know that some models out on the road had problems that they later had to fix. Have they made any comment about that?
Well, both Mr. Toyota and Toyota's head of quality, Mr. Sasaki, both said that Toyota had not was cooperating fully with U.S. Federal authorities and that it had not withheld information.
Do they make any comment about their reputation as a brand that stands for quality and safety? Did they make any comments about that?
Well, Mr. Toyota did tell us that he believed that quality was Toyota's lifeline and that he would put regaining public trust in the company even before profits.
And
so,
they also,
he did.
I was just going to say, they've also said that they're going to be looking into possible problems with the Lexus hybrid as well. Do we get any sense that there could be more announcements of further investigations on other models?
Well, the Lexus hybrid, together with a new model of hybrid, the Sai, which went on sale in Japan, they both use the same brake systems as the newest Prius, the 2010 model. And that's why Toyota is also looking into those models for possible brake problems. However, they told us today that they had yet to find any reports on brake problems in those two models.
Okay, Hiroko Tabuchi is the New York Times business reporter in Japan, speaking about Toyota's president who apologized this morning. It was the first time he'd apologized over the global recall, probably not the last. Thank you so much.
So it's Friday, and in cooperation with our good friends at The Week magazine, we look back to see who had a good week and who didn't. This is our Good Week, Bad Week segment. First up, we learned that, this fuzzy critter who we hear about every February 2nd, right? You know what I'm talking about? Punxsutawney Phil, the groundhog. He made his 124th prediction on Tuesday, forecasting six more weeks of winter. You know, but we learned that he actually has all good weeks. Listen, first of all, here's Michael Johnson, an official with the Punxsutawney Groundhog Club.
This year, he did see his shadow. He was frightened back into his burrow and is anticipating six additional weeks of cold weather.
All right, so bad news for the rest of us, right?
Yeah.
But no, the reason it's a really good week for Punxsutawney Phil is because he wasn't frightened by the folks at PETA who insisted that Phil the groundhog should be replaced by Phil the robot.
To quote our president, Phil is treated better than the average child in the state of Pennsylvania. He has two regularly scheduled visits to a veterinarian each year. He lives in a climate-controlled state licensed and inspected habitat called the Groundhog Zoo, which is right in the center of Punxsutawney. He leads a very coddled life and certainly flourishes in that lifestyle.
Certainly very coddled. What does that say about the state of Pennsylvania, though? I mean, I'm kind of worried about that. Now, Sunday, a lot of Grammy winners had a good week, but winning 4 Grammys can seem less impressive when you sing out of key at the award show.
She wears short skirts, I wear t-shirts, she's cheer captain and I'm on the bleachers.
Yeah, Taylor Swift kind of fell flat there.
It wasn't just a Taylor Swift that fell. She also dropped one of her Grammys as she was walking backstage. Yeah, and she broke it. So not a good week, actually a bad week for Taylor Swift.
If you've got nominations for who had a bad week or a good week in the news, call us at 877-8MYTAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. Listener Abdul Mozip wrote us to nominate Toyota for a bad week and Detroit auto companies like Ford and GM for good week. Not bad. Send us your nominations at the takeaway at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
We're also coming up in just a moment. We're going to be talking about the Baptist group from Idaho are facing charges now of kidnapping after attempting to take 33 Haitian children over the border into the Dominican Republic.
Idaho, there's a independent sort of place, right?
People, they're the cowboy spirit.
Would start their own third parties in a place like Idaho, right?
Speaking of that.
There you go. The Tea Party down in Nashville. In honor of it, we want you to nominate your own party.
The party I would want to have is one that is for the rich, for the owners of this country who made it great. I want to prohibit any poor people from participating. I want corporations to rule the country. I want none of these illegal immigrants to come in. Oh, but I do want a strong military to push our will onto other countries. It's the GOP, isn't it?
That sounds sarcastic.
Ooh, man.
Something tells
our
me
listeners.
He's being facetious.
877-8 my take. My take at thetakeaway.org. A party of one.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Coming up, a closer look at that group of Baptists from Idaho who are now facing charges, serious charges of kidnapping and conspiracy over their attempt to take 33 Haitian children over the border from Haiti into the Dominican Republic. We'll talk about that in a moment. First, let's take a look at the news headlines at 30 minutes after the hour. The unemployment rate in January dropped unexpectedly to 9.7%. Earlier, we spoke to Newsweek columnist Dan Gross, who told us among the highlights from the Labor Department last hour is that there are more manufacturing jobs now.
Companies are adding people. Car companies, you know, production in this quarter is much larger than it was a year ago. So there are kind of incremental gains in manufacturing.
But the news was not all good. All told, 8.5 million jobs have been lost in this recession, the most of any since World War II.
And the markets are reacting this morning after futures were down for Wall Street all morning long. They turned around after that unemployment number came out. The Dow is now open up about 7 points, the S&P up about 2 points, and the NASDAQ up about 8 points. NASDAQ doing the best this morning. Toyota's president officially apologized for the recall problems that have plagued the company in the last few weeks. It also did not announce a recall for problems with brakes on the 2010 Prius. One of the largest offensives in the Afghan war has begun this morning. British attack helicopters clearing the outskirts of the city of Marja in Helmand province in preparation for a larger NATO assault. And here at home, the New York Attorney General's office filed civil charges against Bank of America and its former CEO, Ken Lewis, yesterday. It says the bank misled investors about Merrill Lynch before it acquired that company early last year. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
We have new news out of Haiti this morning. 10 members of an Idaho-based Baptist group have been charged with kidnapping and criminal conspiracy in Haiti after they tried to take 33 children over the border into the Dominican Republic. We're now familiar with the details. They claim the children were orphans. They say they just wanted to help them, but the Haitian government isn't buying that. In fact, they've charged them, as I said, with kidnapping. There's a possibility that they'll serve 15 years in prison if they're convicted, and there is no chance of posting bail. We've also heard that the group's defense attorney, Edwin Koch, apparently blames the group's leader, Laura Silsby, and says she's the only one that should be charged, and she knew she was breaking the law when she started taking the children and attempting to bring them over the border. Joining us now from Port-au-Prince, Haiti, is New York Times reporter Mark Lacey. He's been covering this story, and he was at the courthouse yesterday. Mark, you weren't allowed inside, but you spoke with the prosecutor after the charges were filed, correct?
Yes, I spoke to the prosecutor actually on the way in before the hearing, and I spoke to the attorney for the accused. And this is a case that the missionaries thought was going to end yesterday, but it's going to go on. It could go, could stretch into months, and these detainees, if they're eventually convicted, could spend many years in Haitian jails.
As you said, you spoke with the group's defense attorney, and he blames the group's leader, Laura Silsby. He says she knew that she was breaking the law, but that the other members of the Baptist group that were with her had no idea that they were doing something illegal. Did you get any sense from the prosecutor that the Haitian government is singling out Laura Silsby?
Well, at this point, what the attorney for the 10 actually said is that nine of them were completely unaware what was going on, and they were being led by one, Laura Silsby. He still believes all 10 should get off, that they were not intending to traffic these children, but they weren't knowingly violating the law, he believes. However, he said only one of the 10 can conceivably be charged. His argument, though, didn't fly. The prosecutor charged all 10 of them. And the charges, as you mentioned, were child abduction and conspiracy, but the trafficking charge was dropped for all 10, and that was the most serious charge.
Because they had no evidence that they planned to actually take these children elsewhere. Other than the Dominican Republic.
Exactly. The trafficking charge was the most difficult to prove. The prosecutor didn't really explain why he dropped it, but that was the toughest one to prove. The missionaries were bringing children across the border into the Dominican Republic without proper authorization. That's clear, and that one he believes he can prove.
Okay, Mark Lacy is the Caribbean correspondent with the New York Times. He joined us from Port-au-Prince, Haiti. We're also joined by Mark Johnson, a longtime Idaho resident and president of the Gallatin Public Affairs in Boise. He spent 9 years as chief of staff to Idaho's former governor, Cecil Andrus. Good morning, Mark. Help us understand this Baptist church from Idaho that wanted to go help children in Haiti. Help us understand the community out of which this group came.
First thing you have to understand is it's a very churched area. This is a highly religious state, maybe one of the more religious places in the country in terms of people's attendance, regular attendance at church.
You know, not having lived in Idaho, but just knowing it from the people that I know there, there's this kind of idea of Idaho as this very libertarian, very independent, strong-minded state. And to that extent, this story kind of makes sense, that these are people who saw a problem in Haiti and said, well, we're going to go over there and we're going to fix it.
It's probably a myth in a lot of ways, but there is a notion about the West, and Idaho subscribes to this in the main, that you're a place of rugged individuals. They take action based upon seeing a problem and trying to solve it. So I think the local reaction in the main has been, we're waiting to figure out exactly what happened and what the motivations were, but there's been no rush to condemn. Probably a sense developing that these folks were, to give them the benefit of the doubt, well-intentioned, but probably awfully naive about the way they were going about approaching this, not very sophisticated.
Tell me a little bit about this church and its place within the religious communities. It's a large, very high-profile church with a lot of standing?
I would say no. In fact, I'm only vaguely aware of it. My personal religion is Catholic, which would be kind of the second most dominant religious affiliation in Idaho.
Mormon being the
LDS largest. Community would be very, very strong in this part of Idaho. And then a whole range of from sort of the evangelical, conservative, right, religious right, if you will, to a more mainstream Protestant denominations, the Methodists and that sort of thing. So, but lots of church going, lots of people that are very, very engaged in a sense that, you know, we're trying to help here.
I mean, it sounds like you're describing a community that's kind of waiting to see, that's not rushing to condemn and is having the sort of stay out of everyone else's business attitude. Does that hold clear for pretty much everything in Idaho?
Well, you mentioned the libertarian streak that runs through the state. I think there is a sense that, mind your own business. I won't get in your way if you don't get in mine. And that's a strain that is long dominant.
Or if you're talking about Ruby Ridge, it goes a little beyond that even.
Yeah. And the other thing that I think is going on here, and probably fairly far down the list of concerns in Idaho, but we've had some, as you suggest, John, some image problems in the past that have been driven the narrative that Idaho is a place where crackpots come to reside. An unfair image in my estimation, but nonetheless, I think you're probably seeing a little bit of that reaction at home.
That's Mark Johnson, the president of Gallatin Public Affairs in Boise, former Idaho journalist. He spent 9 years as chief of staff to Idaho's former governor, Cecil Andrus. He's reacting to the news out of Haiti that 10 members of an Idaho-based Baptist group have been charged with kidnapping and criminal conspiracy as they attempted to take 33 kids out of Haiti and into the Dominican Republic. So we're asking you about political parties in the U.S. today. The Tea Party Convention is in its second day, and we're asking you, if you were going to create a political party of your own, what would the platform be and what would you call it? On our website, Charlie writes, the party would be called the Big Middle. It would strive to mobilize all moderates while marginalizing the extreme right and left. What's your take? What would you call your party and what would you fight for if you could make up your own? Let us know at 8778-MYTAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. This is The Takeaway. I'm Celeste Headlee.
And I'm John Huckenberry. Bobby, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. Good morning.
Marshall, yes. President of Online Ticket Selling. Everyticket.com, can you get me tickets for the big game?
I absolutely can. How many would you like, 10, 20, 30?
30? You know, it's a smaller group. Let's say 6. How much is that going to set me back?
Done. If you want to sit premium seats, lower level, probably looking at about $4,000 a ticket, so roughly right around $24,000 to get you into the game.
Now, Bob Marshall, president of Everyticket.com, I would have thought that's a low number. My feeling was, you know, maybe they'd be 10,000. Is the price going to maybe go up between now and actually Sunday?
It could. It kind of bounces around a little bit between that number. I think yesterday was around 3,700. It could probably go up to right around 4,500, somewhere in that ballpark is what we're projecting.
So I'm talking to you. You are in Miami at this point, right?
That's correct.
Now, economic indicators, we look at a lot of them on this program, can we look at the Super Bowl tickets and the market for Super Bowl tickets? And, of course, this is the highest rated, you know, television event possibly in the world. Have they fluctuated this year?
John, they have. It's gone down from the last time the Super Bowl was in Miami. That same ticket I just quoted you at, which is, it's a bargain, was about $8,500, and the Super Bowl was played here in 2007. So for the same type of seat, so you're looking at half the price, basically.
And does that make things bad for you, or does it just mean more people can go and actually get involved?
Well, what actually is happening is less people are going. That's what's bringing the price down, and it's not great for obviously the opportunity is there for people to still come down today, tomorrow, and go to the game for much cheaper than what they've been able to in the years past. As far as bad for us, it's probably better when the price was higher, so there's more margins to work with, sure.
So where do you get your tickets? I mean, do you actually buy them, or do people buy them and then put them on your site and get a piece of the action themselves?
We do carry quite an extensive inventory, but also we do sell other people's tickets as well. So we would get them probably from fans that decided, hey, I can make some money on this ticket. The face value on most of the tickets is anywhere $800 to $1,000. 800 being for a upper level seat, and 1,000 for a lower. And they usually mark them up, and we we see what we can do with them.
All right, if I wanted to sit in the cheapest seat in the stadium, what would that be?
You'd be looking at an upper level. We'd maybe throw in a pair of binoculars, but it'd be about $1,350.
$1,350 still.
Still, exactly correct. But again, in years past, last time the Super Bowl was played here, that ticket was about $3,000.
Now, you know, we're in partnership with ProPublica, who's a website that actually takes a look at Capitol Hill, and we're trying to figure out how maybe congressmen and senators would be going to the game. You know, I'm calling you to try to get tickets. How do lawmakers and big shots actually end up getting tickets usually?
An assistant calls.
Well, that's for sure. But is there a big business in, like, donated tickets or passing them around to VIPs?
What do you mean? Donated tickets like...
I want you to come to the game. I'm going to give you a gift. Are tickets gifted a lot?
Sometimes, yes, that's true. Yes, we actually have gift certificates, and people do call up and say, "Hey, I want to take such and such. This person's been an important part of my whether it's an anniversary gift or for someone as a gift or at work or something. Not much work related lately."
Finally, can you give me the breakdown? New Orleans fans versus Indianapolis fans. Who's winning?
I would say for sure a lot more New Orleans fans.
All
definitely.
Right. Bob Marshall, president of EveryTicket.com, selling premium tickets to sold out events. He's got tickets for the Super Bowl. Get them now.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. I'm Celeste Headlee here with John Hockenberry. What do you get when you combine 19 years of work with 28 gorgeous photographs, 16 amazing writers, and 7 photojournalists all making one project? Well, what you get is a book called Havana and Haiti, which gives us a really nuanced and complex portrait of the relationship between Haitians and Cubans in Miami. We're going to talk about that in a moment. First, here's a check on leading stories at 47 minutes after the hour. This morning, Toyota's president, Akio Toyoda, apologized to customers during his first press conference since the company began its massive recalls. Earlier on The Takeaway, we spoke with New York Times reporter Hiroko Tabuchi in Japan. She elaborated on the message from this morning's conference.
Well, Mr. Toyota did tell us that he believed that quality was Toyota's lifeline and that he would put regaining public trust in the company even before profit.
The company's president also admitted the 2010 Prius has brake problems. He did not announce a recall, though. He's only saying the company is considering one. And in economic news, the Labor Department says the unemployment rate fell slightly last month to 9.7% from 10% in December.
And the markets are reacting accordingly, opening flat, not repeating yesterday's huge, huge sell-off. In Washington, GOP Senator Scott Brown of Massachusetts was sworn in yesterday, a week earlier than planned. And the big story this weekend, the Mid-Atlantic bracing for a serious winter storm, two feet of snow, expected in some areas from Virginia to New Jersey. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
This week, we welcome Miami and all of South Florida to the Takeaway family with WLRN down there. And we've been talking to some very prominent thinkers and writers from the region, prize-winning writers like Dave Barry and Leonard Pitts and Alpha Edwige Dantica. Two of those writers, Pitts and Dantica, contributed to a collection of essays and photographs that not just caught our eye, it catches the eye. The collection is called Havana and Haiti, Two Cultures, One Community. It was produced by our guests, Carl Just and Luis Rios. They're co-founders of the Miami-based Iris Photo Collective. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
Luis, let's talk about some of the photos in here. There was one pair of photos that really struck me, and it's the only black and white set of photos in there. I'm looking at it now. On one side of the page, you have a black and white photo of two prostitutes in Havana. They're standing in the middle of the street. One is adjusting her hair, it looks like, and the other one's talking really animated with her purse slung over her back. On the other side, juxtaposed, is a photo out of Haiti with two little girls, possibly sisters, I guess, wide-eyed, looking at the camera, very beautiful little girls. One's clasping the other's hands to her breast, and they're dressed in these lovely lace little dresses. I guess they're going to communion. I mean, the picture of innocence juxtaposed with the photo of these prostitutes out of Havana. And I'm wondering how you chose these photos, what you were trying to say about these two communities.
What we have here are really two independent looks, I think, at in a very artistic way, the harshness of living, in a place like Haiti and a place like Cuba. That you can almost switch the two photographs. What's happening is there is a first communion day for the two young girls in Haiti. The other one are two young girls in the early morning hours, after what we call the day's work. And when I first decided to put these together, this is the only pair of photographs that we compare and contrast. They're actually run in black and white for the sheer purpose of looking strictly at context. You really have innocence in both photographs, and that was the intent of that. And to run them in black and white was really a way to point out the starkness and show the sort of the similarities between these two cultures.
There's another pair of photographs. In fact, let me contrast a couple of them, because there's a pair of photographs in which you show one Haitian detainee and one Cuban detainee, both of them in Guantanamo Bay. And those are sad photographs. They're not especially happy. But at the same time, you have photos of this incredibly colorful, looks like a sunrise, and a stone angel coming out of Havana. And out of Haiti, you've got this beautiful blue skyline over the ocean in Haiti, and the side of a boat that said "God love me." It's like you have this message here of how complicated this is. These communities where life is so very difficult, and yet the people are so resilient and clinging on to hope.
And that's the point that we make. You know, with the entire set of photographs, pretty much what we have learned about Haiti. Sort of in a backward way, and Cuba, more specifically Havana, is that both of these peoples throw themselves into the ocean to come to South Florida, Miami specifically, for either political reasons or economic reasons. In both cases, in both of those countries, we know about the economic upheaval, you know, and the complete desolation of Haiti. You look at Havana and the unending wait for the fall of a dictator for the last 50 years that appears that it will never come. And what we do with the angel in Cuba, in Havana, is to offer hope. And that is the way that the Cubans, especially the expatriates that live in South Florida, the United States, look to. The people there, this is a constant struggle for them. With Haiti, it's the very same thing. Both have strong Roman Catholicism backgrounds, and that is ingrained into their culture. I think when they look to the United States to come to, that's the only way of freedom that they expect. There's a very famous line in a song that says, that talks about freedom, which means there's nothing left to lose. And for both of these peoples, there is nothing left to lose to obtain that freedom that they both so dearly, you know, want.
That's photojournalist Luis Rios. He's half of the team that produced this new book, Havana and Haiti, Two Cultures, One Community. The other is photojournalist Carl Joost. He's with the Miami Herald and co-founder of the Iris Photo Collective. Carl, did you go when you were taking these photos? Did you go knowing what kind of photos you wanted to take?
No, actually, these photos span 19 years, and they were never meant to be paired together. It's during the course of having an exhibit during our Basel in Miami, Luis and I kind of put our heads together and we started looking at images from both countries and saw, wow, this is dynamic bridge, this is the dynamic visual narrative that connects the two. And personally, my mother lived in Cuba and is of Cuban descent, and I'm, of course, was born in Haiti. So it is this dualism that keeps repeating in my life. So it was just a natural fit.
You know, in there you have a picture of Havana with the rainbow over it, which we were listening to Luis talk about. And there's another one that's a picture of Port-au-Prince before the earthquake, which is just a beautiful photograph. And there, it seems to be a comment upon the struggling and the suffering these two communities have gone through and how that has transformed them, maybe in parallel ways.
Yeah, I think both of them have a sense of home. And both of them are departing their home because they seek a better future. That rainbow that casts over Havana, yes, it's beautiful, but you look at the buildings, they seem to be dated and deteriorating. Again, like Mr. Rios, as Luis had said, hope, faith, freedom are themes that keep echoing throughout this project. It was very important. Both Luis and I really respect the written word, and we also respect the visual narrative, but we wanted to have both narratives be take equal space in the book. So we went through a lot of pain and design to make sure that one complements the other.
19 years of work represented in this project with 28 really, really beautiful images that you can actually see on our website, thetakeaway.org. That's Carl Juste, a photojournalist at the Miami Herald, and Luis Rios, a photojournalist and editor of the Iris Photo Collective's latest book, Havana and Haiti, Two Cultures, One Community. Really, I encourage you to take a look at the pictures at thetakeaway.org.
Well, and the one community we're welcoming this week into the Takeaway family is South Florida, joining us on WLRN, and those images and all of the coverage of South Florida that we've had this week is available on our website. And we've also been covering the Tea Party. Their convention moves into day two. We've been asking all of you to tell us the platforms of your new political party.
Hi. My party is going to be to vote the bums out, and it's kind of self-explanatory.
Hey, Troy calling from North Dakota. My new political party platform would advocate maintaining enough of our armed forces just for homeland defense only, and redesign the remaining forces and equipment to form the ultimate disaster response machine.
Hi, this is Susanna King in Aiken, South Carolina. My party platform would simply be do unto others as you would have them do unto you.
Thanks, Susanna. You can join the party. Form your own at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org.
I'm Celeste Edley.
Have a good weekend. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Thanks for listening to the Takeaway podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.